Nemoto presents classical music giants. Claudio Monteverdi, The Birth of Modern Opera. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 18 minutes. The room is small, warm with candle smoke, and full of instruments that don't quite belong together. Cornets with their leather-wrapped curves, long-necked chitarroni lounging like cats, sackbuts glinting a dull brass, violins resting softly in their cases. A page steps forward with news from the stage manager. Guests have taken their seats in the Ducal Palace at Mantua. The Duke expects novelty and polish. The musicians check their strings and reeds. A fanfare, spare and ceremonial, is ready to sound from an upper gallery. It is 1607, and the court will hear something new that still recognizes everything old. In the middle of this bustle stands a middle-aged Kapellmeister with a face both austere and compassionate, the look of a man who has measured his own griefs and learned how to turn them into form. Claudio Monteverdi nods once, and the toccata rolls out like a banner being unfurled. He has spent his life bringing the human voice and the human heart back to the center of music, and tonight the ancient singer Orpheus will walk on stage to prove that a person speaking truth plainly, on a thread of bass and breath, can move heaven and hell. He did not start at court. He started in a provincial city, Cremona, famous for its churches and, later in the next century, for instrument makers whose names would become talismans. Amati, Guarneri, Stradivari. In the 1570s and 1580s, Cremona was also a place where a gifted boy could enter a choir, learn counterpoint by copying pages, and find a teacher strict enough to give him rules and tolerant enough to let him test the boundaries. Monteverdi's teacher, Marcantonio Ingegneri, trained him in the discipline of Renaissance polyphony, lines that interweave like careful stitching, each voice a citizen obeying the laws of dissonance and resolution. As a teenager, Monteverdi had the audacity to publish first small sacred pieces, then his first book of madrigals. Early success is not always a promise. Sometimes it is a pressure. He learned quickly that printed music circulated reputations almost as fast as it circulated songs. When the Gonzaga family in Mantua hired him in the 1590s, he entered a court that wanted spectacle, ballets, intermedii, feasts in which mythological allegories flattered real princes. He played the viola da braccio, he supervised rehearsals, he composed tirelessly, and he married a court singer, Claudia, who carried her own light into those rooms. He also discovered that the old rules were not enough for new stories. In the madrigal, the poetry mattered. A single wounded word, ah, alas, death, could justify a chord that broke the teaching of the treatises, because what mattered most was the meaning of the text as felt by a listener who possessed a body and a history. That conviction, words first, rules second, would become the compass of his life. Not everyone admired the compass. Around 1600, a conservative theorist, Giovanni Maria Artusi, published a book whose title still bites, On the Imperfections of Modern Music. The modern music he meant was Monteverdi's. Those clashes, those prepared-unprepared dissonances, those sudden turns when a phrase had to show pain or desire so honestly that decorum cracked. Artusi accused, Monteverdi did not answer in a pamphlet war. He answered in art. He also let his brother Giulio write the printed defense. There exists, Giulio explained, a second practice in which the text is the mistress of the harmony. First practice, prima pratica, is the old Palestrina code of smoothness and suspension. Second practice, seconda pratica, uses the full range of musical resources to serve the poem, the character, the moment. What mattered for Monteverdi was not to rebel for rebellion's sake, but to enlarge the space of truth that music could carry. To enlarge that space, he needed tools. One tool was basso continuo, the foundation line over which a singer could speak flexibly. Another was the new habit of alternating speech-like recitative with more patterned song, so that the audience might hear thought turn into feeling and back again. Another was the color of instruments, cornets for brilliance, violins for heat, trombones for solemn authority, deployed as painters deploy light and shade. He also learned courage from theater itself. A messenger enters and the world changes. A lament descends and time slows. A dance returns and the body remembers it was born to move. When he wrote L'Orfeo, he brought all of that together. The Orpheus myth was a perfect stage for him because it described the power he was searching for. The power of song to persuade, to break laws, to argue with death. The prologue enters with music personified, a declaration that what we are about to hear is not mere ornament but force. Orfeo sings of joy, then the messenger enters, always the messenger, and announces Eurydice's death. The scene is spare, almost cruelly plain. A woman speaks news and a man's world ends. In Monteverdi's hands, the shock is not delivered in ornate display but in the sudden naked line of recitative, a line that seems almost not to be singing at all until we feel how the notes cling to the edges of the words. Orfeo's Tu is immorta does not explain, it exposes. When later he sings Passant Spurto, at the threshold of the underworld, the music becomes ceremony, an audition before the judges. The ornaments are not peacock feathers. They are exact instruments of persuasion, turning a plea into a demonstration of mastery over breath and tone. If you want to hear where opera learns to be both theater and music, stand inside that aria and listen to the alternation of string and wind ritornelli. The world answers the human voice like a mind thinking between sentences. At the same time Monteverdi wrote the Vespers of 1610. If Orfeo is new wine poured into a new skin, the Vespers is a new wine poured into a chalice inherited from centuries of worship. He binds old psalm tones to new concerted brilliance. He places the humble chant in a frame of opulent sonority. He lets solo voices bloom above walking basses and obbligato lines. He invites cornets and sackbuts to help us imagine what light looks like when the sun goes down and the church lights its candles. The paradox is deliberate. He refuses the false choice between tradition and innovation. In piece after piece, Nigra sum duo seraphim, Ave Maristella, he shows that a believer may pray with the grammar of the future without losing the mother tongue of the past. But Mantua was not a paradise. The court demanded, the purse strings tightened, a patron could sour overnight. Monteverdi worked himself thin and asked for raises that did not come. His wife died and grief took up residence beside exhaustion. In 1613 Venice called and he answered. The Basilica of San Marco wanted a new maestro di cappella. Venice, unlike Mantua, was a republic of merchants and theaters where a talent might breathe among citizens rather than courtiers. At San Marco he found a building that was itself an instrument, galleries facing galleries, stone that warmed to sound, a tradition of antiphonal music in which choirs sang across space as if the architecture were a score. He strengthened the chapel, trained players and singers, and wrote sacred works that folded ceremonial splendor into intimate expression. Venice also offered a different stage. In 1637, the city opened a public opera house. To buy a ticket for myth turned into music, that was new, almost scandalous. Opera stepped down from palaces and walked into a city that could argue with it, judge it, love it, return next week for more. Monteverdi, now in his 60s and then his 70s, did not retreat to dignified retirement. He returned to the theater as if a muscle memory had been recovered. He had already invented or at least demonstrated a new rhetorical weapon in his eighth book of madrigals. The style concitato, the agitated style, in which repeated notes and pulsing patterns conjure the quickened breath of anger and combat. In Il Combattimento di Tancredi e Clorinda he stages a duel with motion so tight, so clipped, that the listener feels the edge of the blade. This was not violence for spectacle. It was an acknowledgement that the passions, affetti, include rage as well as love, and that a truthful art must make room for both. Two late operas carry his mature voice into shared memory. Il Ritorno di Ulisse in Patria takes a hero home not to triumphal processions but to recognition scenes full of doubt, disguises, tenderness, and tests. The music knows how domestic wisdom sounds. Small arcs of melody that turn on a word and sit close to speech, sudden spurts of joy that relax into patterns the ear can follow. L'Incoronazione di Papia is a more dangerous object. Here public power and private desire dance so closely that you cannot tell which leads. Monteverdi paints a world in which lovers win even when they should not, in which victory is voluptuous and morally ambiguous, in which a duet can be both beautiful and chilling. The final love duet, floating on the sighing figure of two voices that curve toward each other and then hang, seems to promise transcendence and instead delivers exposure. This is what it sounds like when people choose pleasure over principle with total conviction. Baroque opera would often teach by moral example. Monteverdi allows us the discomfort of recognizing ourselves. Across all these works, the same courage appears: to risk simplicity in an age that made a cult of complexity. Renaissance polyphony is one of the glories of human craft, and Monteverdi knew it inside out. But he was willing to shorten the distance between word and tone, to let a character say, "I am wounded," without a labyrinth of notes to rescue the line from nakedness. He was also willing to improvise with forms, to treat the emerging aria like a tool among others rather than a template. Ritornello forms give listeners handholds, recitative gives the poet air, duets let sympathy be heard without speechifying, dance rhythms let the body re-enter the story, ground bases, those repeating foundations, turn grief or obsession into something objective and formal, like a column you can touch. Listen, for instance, to the descending line that anchors his Lamento della Ninfa. The bass repeats and repeats. Above it a woman pours out her sorrow. Around her three male voices comment as if a Greek chorus had wandered into a city street. This is not just harmony, it is dramaturgy. The Passacaglia and Chaconne laments that fill later Baroque opera owe their power to this intuition. If you must weep, let the floor be steady. The aspect of Monteverdi most likely to convert a new listener is his ear for the voice in all its registers. Not range, but kinds of speech. He can write for a sovereign who must command, for a messenger who must wound, for a young lover whose melody stumbles as desire outruns breath, for a saint whose prayer makes even instrumentalists listen as if they could see light. He pays full attention to the vowels of Italian, stretching them when time must slow, clipping them when comedy must turn fast. He decorates not to dazzle but to clarify. In Passant Sperto the ornaments show the underworld that Orpheus controls himself. In the Vespers motets, melismas do not flutter. They ascend like steps that must be mounted one by one. None of this would matter if his sense of pacing were weak. It is not. He knows that meaning lives in proportions. How long a silence lasts after a blow has fallen, how many bars elapse before a memory returns, how quickly a ritornello should repeat so that it feels like recognition and not like nagging, how to place a high note so that the audience does not merely hear it but leans toward it. When he moves the harmony in an unexpected way, you feel your stomach click. When he lets the bass walk in patient steps under a sudden bright figure in the violins, you feel what hope feels like when it has learned patience. And when he writes a cadence that refuses to end, hovering, it is because thought has not yet concluded, and thought rules the bar line. The life continued to bruise him. Venice suffered plague, finances seesawed, friends died, he was ordained a priest, a step that for him did not end a worldly vocation so much as consecrated. He wrote letters begging for decent treatment, then returned to work. He trained younger musicians who would carry his methods forward without copying his modesty. He saw a new economy of entertainment grow around him, a commercial stage where sellable passions threatened to outshout subtle ones. That he thrived in that market without surrendering his integrity is one measure of his intelligence. Another is the ease with which he moved between sacred and secular, refusing the lie that a devout artist must write pale music or that worldly theater must be godless. He put the human voice in front and then kept asking it to tell the truth. For a long time after his death in 1643, his name faded into footnotes while later masters, Handel and Vivaldi, then Gluck and Mozart, then Verdi and Wagner, seemed to fill the sky. That is the fate of founders. They become the ground their heirs walk on, and we forget to look down. The 20th century revival of early music, with period instruments and scholars willing to dust off neglected scores, brought him back. Modern players learned how a cornet speaks, how a theorbo supports, how a sackbut can rise from mere gloom to noble weight. More importantly, singers learned to trust words as Monteverdi trusted them. Listen to a great performance of the Vespers and you hear how confidence sounds when it is not blared. Listen to Ulysses and Poppea and you hear how the theater grew honest before it grew giant. It is easy to say that Monteverdi invented opera, and it is easy to argue that he did not, because there were experiments before him and parallel paths beside him. What he did was better than invent. He made opera urgent. He found the balance between saying and singing that keeps drama moving, and he accepted that the voice would wear 100 masks in a single evening. Narrator, lover, citizen, supplicant, witness, and must remain credible in all of them. He set a standard that later composers would challenge and complicate but rarely contradict. Treat the stage as a place where people believe they can change each other, and write music that makes that belief contagious. If you come to him for the first time, enter gently. Start with the Lamento della Ninfa. The bass walks, the woman speaks, the world listens. move to Orfeo and let the messenger break your heart. Allow yourself to be surprised by laughter and some madrigals. Monteverdi is not all thunder and tears. He can wink without smirking. Visit the Vespers at dusk, when the city outside your window is loud but you can still feel what a church feels like when candles become the sun. Then when you are ready, dare Poppia. Accept that beauty and goodness are not always twins. Notice how the final duet teaches your ears to want what the characters want, and then ask yourself whether the music has told the whole truth or whether it has told a truth that needs to be questioned. Monteverdi believed that art could be a mirror and a school. He also believed that adults must use what they learn. We live in an age that likes to pretend novelty is freedom. Monteverdi, living at the border between Renaissance and Baroque, did something more demanding. He made freedom feel responsible. He took old disciplines, counterpoint, modal harmony, church polyphony, and allowed them to survive by changing. He refused to confuse polish with honesty or decorum with mercy. He wrote for bodies as much as for souls, for the city as much as for the court, for prayer as much as for love. He trusted that if you give the voice a base to stand on and a word to serve, it will find its pitch. In the end, that is what his work sounds like, a voice finding its pitch in a world that rarely offers it. His music does not merely endure because it is beautiful or historically significant. It endures because it gives us back a very old permission. Speak plainly. Mean what you say. Let the music do whatever is necessary to carry the meaning intact. If you listen across his career, from the first madrigals through the middle books where the debates with Artusi shadow the pages, on to the sacred splendors and the stage works of his last decades, you hear a life working toward clarity. You also hear the cost. There is fatigue in some letters, resignation in some cadences. And then there is renewal, the way a ritornello returns with slightly different harmony and you realize that going back is not the same as standing still. The man who wrote so convincingly of love and loss understood both intimately. The man who gave power to the messenger's entrance knew how troubling truth can be. The man who let laments walk on a repeating ground knew how sorrow visits in patterns. And the man who allowed a corrupt court to sing in intoxicating beauty knew exactly what he was doing. He trusted us to keep our wits while we admired. Imagine him one last time in Venice. The basilica glows. Outside, the lagoon catches late light and turns it to gold leaf. Inside, players tune softly. A singer warms up on an open vowel that seems to melt the distance between centuries. The maestro lifts his hand. The first notes do not try to impress. Why would they? They simply open a space in which words can act. And then words begin to act, mounted on bass and breath, escorted by strings and winds, measured by a mind that has spent decades deciding what matters. You can call that moment Baroque or modern, sacred or theatrical. It is simpler to call it human. Monteverdi's gift is to return us there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Classical Music Giants.